Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Will Clark, Senior Communication Studies major and videographer at Gustavus, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me, your host, Greg Castor. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College. Passionate, enthusiastic, and excited about history are just some of the words Gustavus students have used in praising the teaching of my colleague and History Department Chair, Professor Kate Keller. Kate joined the History Department in 2011 after a stint at another liberal arts institution, Eckerd College in Florida. She earned her BA in History and French from Notre Dame in 1999 and her PhD in History from Rutgers in 2007. An expert in, to quote her, the history of connections between France and West Africa in the 20th century, especially related to colonialism, Kate is the author of the highly regarded book Colonial Suspects, Suspicion, Imperial Rule, and Colonial Society in Interwar French Africa, published in 2018. Currently, she is at work on a second book focused on the life of one of those colonial suspects. Kate teaches a variety of exciting and important courses in African, European, French, and world history, and is active as a faculty leader, not only chairing our department both before and now during the COVID-19 pandemic, but also co-chairing the Global Engagement Committee, participating in the African Studies Program, which she will begin directing later this year, and serving as the faculty representative on the all-important Benefits Advisory Committee. She is, in short, an esteemed college and accomplished historian and teacher, and I am delighted to have this chance to converse with her away from the proverbial office water cooler about history and her work. So welcome, Kate. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Greg.
My pleasure. We're both historians, so let's start the way historians typically do with your own history, your own path. You attended Notre Dame. Did you do an MA there as well, or just the BA?
Bachelor's degree, history and French, yeah.
Okay. So what led you there, one, and two, what led you into both history and French?
Mm-hmm. Sure. A lot of times we talk about our students and how they select a college, and they don't always make decisions, I think, based on the things we think we would like them to, and I'm a perfect example of that. My sister was a student at St. Mary's College in South Bend, which is a women's college that's like a partner institution at Notre Dame, and I visited her there, and I decided I wanted to go to Notre Dame, and so it was partly to get a little bit closer to my sister, and also that I knew it was a great school and a great university. I was a high school student in New Jersey. And I had actually grown up in Ohio, though. And so I was a little bit more geared towards the Midwest. So more than I would say the other students at my New Jersey high school. And so Notre Dame just seemed like a great, great option for me. As for history and French was something that I got really interested in as early as seventh or eighth grade when I started taking French classes. I really wanted to keep up with the French language. I wanted to go to France so badly, and a study abroad program was an important thing I was looking for in a college. And so Notre Dame had a year-long sophomore year program. That was another thing that drew me to the school. And I was just really interested in becoming fluent in a language. I had never been abroad before. The first time I went to France, to Europe was when I went for my study abroad program. So 9 months in France, and I didn't come home that whole time. I had always loved history. You know, as a kid, I loved things like Little House on the Prairie or, like fictionalized, historical accounts. I loved social studies. I loved learning about people and where they were from. That was something that had always fascinated me. And going into college, I was thinking, I'm interested in French. I'm really interested in Europe. I think I'm going to study international relations because, you know, that's a practical field. You know, that's a practical choice. And so I took one class in international relations, which is a perfectly wonderful field, but it was not for me. Because I started really realizing that what I was interested in was like ordinary people and their stories more than high politics. So I would not have gone into sort of a history of high politics either, or diplomacy or anything like that. So I just, you know, it was kind of like I always knew history was the thing I loved, you know. And so I declared my history major before I went to France my sophomore year. And then it was just really natural to do the French major too, because I had learned the language. So I was really, my main goal was to learn the language. But as you're learning a foreign language, you study the literature. And so I was, you know, I loved studying French poetry. I loved reading French novels. And so I did the second major in French literature as well.
Where were you in France in this what part in the study abroad?
It's Angers, France. It's in Western France. It's a smaller city. It's near Orléans or Nantes. It's about an hour and a half train ride from Paris. And the idea that we were told was that it was a great place to learn French because you weren't in sort of the international city of Paris, which is, you know, so global. Sure. I'm not sure if that's necessarily the best reason, but it was a wonderful experience for me. I lived with a French family and just learned so much from that experience and just broadened my horizons in so many ways. I mean, I think I thought I would learn the French language and culture, but, you know, as most people know, you learn so much more on study abroad than just the language. So.
Right. And I know how important study abroad is to you still as a professor and advising our students and your work in internationalizing the curriculum, which maybe we can get into in a bit. Mm-hmm. I'm struck by the fact that you chose a school because you wanted to be close to your sister. Some siblings might go the other way.
It was not the most, I mean, it is a good school. I'm glad I went there. I had a wonderful education. I had a great experience there. I guess I'm just trying to say it was not the most rational decision. I mean, I certainly did not have a career plan or anything like that. I knew they had the study abroad program that was appealing to me. I was probably not quite ready to be in a big city. At that time, you know, I was a little shy and nervous about starting college. And so, yeah, those are all things that factor in, you know, things that we don't always think about and when we're professors, but as young people, you have so many things going on in your mind.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you're reminding me, my brother and I attended the same school for our BAs, Northern Illinois University in DeKalb outside of Chicago. And at one point even roomed together, which was a total mistake, a nightmare. But we made it through and are still close. I assume you're still close to your sister.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
From Notre Dame, you went to Rutgers. What was it about Rutgers and its PhD program that drew you there?
Well, Rutgers is in New Jersey, which is where my family was and is still. And I heard about Rutgers history PhD program through my Notre Dame advisor, Tom Castleman, who's a French historian. And we were talking about what are some programs for me. And I was, again, being irrational. I was thinking about places I'd like to live, like, oh, North Carolina. You know, I wasn't thinking about what was the best history program for me. But Tom said, you should look at Bonnie Smith. She is a great advisor of historians at Rutgers, and she's a French historian. And my first reaction was, I don't want to go to Rutgers, right? I don't want to go back to New Jersey. At that time, by the time I graduated from college, I was really ready to go to a big city. I actually really wanted to go to NYU at first. That was my thought. Huh. They do have a great French studies program there, and I considered that school. And my mom was excited about me going to Rutgers and being closer to home. And I eventually visited the Rutgers history program. It's a really great program. It's a really large history program, and I met a lot of great students there. I met quite a few faculty in European history. At that time, I was really thinking about doing a project about France during World War II. I had not gotten into African studies in terms of my own research. And, you know, I actually ended up talking to Bonnie Smith on the phone and talking to her about what was going on at Rutgers. And I just... I knew that she was the right advisor for me. So I did actually end up making a good choice, I think, based on who would be a good advisor to me. And she was a really wonderful advisor, and she still is. She's just a wonderful person professionally and personally. She's hugely inspiring, and she's just, I've learned so much from her. And so I did end up choosing my program based on my advisor, which was the right way, I think, to choose a graduate program.
Right. And because especially advising is important at the undergraduate level. Your case is another case in point, but also that PhD advisor choice is a fraught one. It can really sometimes make or break, and you did choose well. So how did you move from into French West Africa? How did that come about?
So I actually, at Notre Dame, I did take a class on Francophone African literature. So that was kind of like my first entry into that. But I didn't really think that I was going to do that as in terms of my own research for my dissertation or anything. But I started working on some research stuff, and I had actually done as my senior thesis at Notre Dame. It was an independent study. It wasn't required, but I had done research on French men who had done forced labor in Germany during World War II. And I had done oral histories with them, which was during some of my study abroad that I had done that. And so I was really interested in World War II. I was really interested in the occupation and the kinds of moral choices people are forced to make under the circumstances of occupation. And Bonnie, my advisor, was kind of trying to push me to broaden my horizons a little bit. And she was like, why don't you think about colonialism as another type of occupation, right? This time the French are the occupiers. They're not, subject to occupation. And it was, she was right. World War II France was at that time, I think, a really oversaturated topic. And it probably is still. It's something I love teaching about. I have a course on it, and I still love that subject. But I think she was right in saying, you should probably, get broader than that. We were talking about possibly a comparative project. So I sort of moved into thinking about forced labor in the colonies. I was struggling with that topic, though, because I wasn't really finding the sources that I was interested in. And at that time, many other grad students in French history were beginning to work on colonialism. And I think a lot of people were going to Algeria. That was kind of like the natural place to kind of turn research attention to. I picked West Africa partly because I had studied some of the literature, and I guess I just thought maybe I would do something a little bit different from what other people were doing. I'm not really sure. I had an African history professor at Rutgers, Al Howard, who I had learned some of the Atlantic World stuff with. And he was really fantastic in kind of helping me learn African history just by giving me lots of books to read and things like that. So that was kind of how I went in that direction. Then I started actually trying to figure out a dissertation topic. I was still trying to work on the forced labor situation before I went to France, which I had a fellowship to go do some research in France. And I went in to see Bonnie and told her, I said, I don't think I can do the forced labor project. I just don't think it's going to work. And she said, okay, well, just go there and see what you find. And I did. And, that's when I, basically had to get into the archives. And I think that's one of the challenges of doing research internationally, is that it's really hard to know what you're going to find in the archives. So you try to come up with a plan before you go. But I really had to kind of start from scratch in the archives, figuring out what kind of topic I wanted to do. But at that point, I was really committed to this idea about the connections between France and West Africa, and where was I going to kind of go from there? So
it sounds like the topic, colonial suspects, mm-hmm. Or what became your book, your dissertation, then your book, kind of grew out of your work in the archives. Is that right?
Absolutely. I had one idea, which was something about sort of Paris and Dakar and, you know, kind of connecting those places and finding like travel memoirs and newspaper articles. And I was really interested in Dakar as a city. And I was kind of trying to make that work and it wasn't really happening. And then I decided, I was like, I'll start looking at police records, you know, because that is an area where I could like get a sense of like what was happening in the city of Dakar. And I thought perhaps I would find these like interactions between people, you know, French people, African people, what is, you know, their sort of everyday story, which was something I was looking for. I was expecting to find things like people getting arrested, fights in bars, petty theft, you know, that's what I thought would be in the police files. And actually what was in it were the suspicious persons files.
That's so great.
Yeah. And some of the first ones I found were really about foreigners. And I thought, oh, I guess I can't use this. You know, this is all about foreigners. I'm interested in French people, African people, you know, and their connections. And then eventually I got to the point where I was like, oh, actually, I think I can, you know, maybe this is a part of the story. And it did end up being a big part of my research. And it's a chapter of my book about the role of foreigners. And so that was exciting. And, you know, as a historian, that you can find things in archives that really make you, I mean, so much of archival research can be really dry. But then if you can find something right. That's interesting to read, it's just amazing. And so
your research and your book are anything but dry. And it's just a great example of how, you know, some people might think, oh, well, maybe she's a suspicious person herself. Maybe that's what drew you to the topic, but, or you had it all figured out in advance, but you didn't, which is, you know, not always, but often the case. You know, what we find either in particular sources that take us in a particular direction that we didn't quite anticipate, or, you know, in your case, finding your topic in the archives. Let's talk about the book. It's a terrific book. It is a great read. And every time I read it, I imagine a masterpiece theater, you know, or some kind of series on it based on it with all the atmospherics. But tell us a little bit about the book. And maybe if you'd like, if the best way is to read a bit from it, by all means.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'll start by explaining a little bit about the book. As I was explaining to you earlier, I started with the suspicious persons files, you know, and they were like, you know, basically reports about people who were usually in Dakar, the capital city of French West Africa, which is in Senegal now, it's the capital of Senegal now, but also in lots of other parts of the Federation of French West Africa. And so to me, that is the heart of the book. It's actually the last three chapters of the book is where I describe the suspects and their life experiences. And there are Frenchmen, foreigners, and Africans. Their lives overlap. Some of them are involved in politics. Some of them are involved in shady behavior that is like maybe they're crooked or they have a secret identity or they're trying to escape their past, all kinds of things. Some of them, so it's just this wide range of experiences that emerge from the lives of the suspects. The first part of the book is about the police and the government in general and why they were, you know, looking into these suspects. And so that's something that I write about pretty extensively to kind of like establish the context and why this was happening and also to make some historical arguments about what this means for understanding French colonialism and to try to engage with some of those historical debates. But I will read to you a little bit of the beginning of the book, which sets the scene in terms of who the suspects are and hopefully gives you a sense of why their lives are so interesting.
That's okay, great. So, thank you.
So this is from the introduction to my book.
Okay.
In the summer of 1937, Baron Paul von Heinel, holding both Bolivian and Austrian passports, arrived in the Senegalese port of Dakar. His stay in Senegal followed a visit to the British African colony of Gold Coast, where he had met with members of the Nazi Party. In Dakar, he claimed to be researching business prospects in the sale of goods, such as cameras and hurricane lamps. The passage of such a foreigner to the capital of French West Africa in the late 1930s was not unusual. Dakar was a city that teemed with itinerant Frenchmen and cosmopolitan foreigners seeking opportunity and adventure. A seedy nightlife emerged, featuring epileptic dancers, strippers, and lounge singers had emerged to cater to the pleasures of just such a crowd. Like many visitors to Dakar, von Heinel might have dined with his foreign friends at the popular Hotel Metropole, where the head chef, the Vietnamese Nguyen Van Phu, once received a packet of Marxist journals from an anonymous source in Paris. The Metropole did not look lavish from the exterior, but it was the place in Dakar to see and be seen for Europeans seeking to catch wind of local intrigue. Nguyen, as the cook, lived an existence far removed from the lifestyles of the well-heeled patrons who dined at the hotel. He had spent a few grueling years as the cook on commercial steamships based out of Marseille. Now settled in Dakar with a steady paycheck and guaranteed room and board at one of the poshest addresses in town, he still lived an austere life. Just a few years prior to Nguyen's reception of the unexpected journals, Monsieur Perissac, the owner of the firm where von Heinel's friends worked, became acquainted with a young Senegalese man named Amadou Sall while spending time in Bordeaux. Sall had traveled to Paris and to the United States, spoke English, and belonged to the Paris-based group League of Defense of the Negro Race. Sall was generally reserved, but known to share confidences with the aid of a little wine. He also supposedly maintained correspondence with an extremist in Niger and somewhat mysteriously sent mail to an address in Brooklyn, New York. Although from very different strata of Dakar society, tenuous connections link von Heinel, Nguyen, and Sall. They have something else in common. They were all considered suspicious persons by the police and government general of French West Africa.
It's just great. I mean, again, you know, first of all, the intrigue and the mystery I just love. And secondly, reviewers have rightly commented on how lively and engaging your writing is, and it shows through there and the way you make these connections. Was this kind of surveillance peculiar to the French in colonial West Africa? Do you know, or
there's been a lot of actually recent works on surveillance as a part of colonial histories, not only of Africa, but, you know, going into like American colonialism and the Philippines and, you know, in North Africa and also in Asia. And, you know, there's lots of different examples of this where I would say, you know, political surveillance was a part of life. And the main goal of these kinds of surveillance operations was largely to suppress nationalist movements. Absolutely, it's something that's not unique to French West Africa. What I'm trying to do with my work is to use sort of the files and use all the information that comes out of it to kind of get an inside look at what was happening with people's lives in this context. So I'm sort of like working against the grain a little bit in terms of, you know, I do write about the police and what they were doing, but I'm really more interested in like what kinds of information you can get from those files and to kind of get a sense of like what these places were like and what it was like to be there and to experience that. So in my reading on the subject in terms of the other secondary sources, I would say that while this kind of surveillance is really common, it's really hard to find those kinds of details. And I'm not sure if it's because other historians are just like passing by them. Whereas I get it, like, you know, like I'm always reading about like, okay, this is going to be a book about surveillance. And then they'll talk about like the sort of methods and what they found and not like the kind of nitty gritty details that I'm more interested in. So,
yeah, you wonder if it's the lack of sources or they're passing it by because they're not, you just said you read against the grain and that's important. Could you explain for listeners what that means?
Sure.
Historians often write about, you know, working or reading against the grain of the evidence.
So, I mean, to read them with the grain is to be like, what were the police thinking? What did they want? What were they using them for? Which I do in the book. I talk about that in the first two chapters. But then I try to be like, okay, what is sort of the story that's underneath it? You know, what if the person is not actually a communist, like this man, this Vietnamese man at the hotel?
Yes, the chef, right?
Yeah. What sort of like life was he living? What was he doing in Dakar? You know, instead of like the French were like, was he a Marxist? You know, and is he trying? He actually had turned in all the journals that he received. He was trying to like be an informant and a source, and they were just like, he is a suspect. You know, so that's what they want to know, is like, what was he a Marxist? And I did spend a lot of time when I first started this project being like, is this all paranoia or did it really happen? You know, were there like these massive movements of opposition to the French, or was it mostly their imagination? And I eventually kind of moved away from that because mostly I was interested in sort of like, who were these people and why did they come to the attention of the police?
Well, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, just to say that that's what I want to get out of the sources. But I also tried to read them with the grain in terms of understanding what the police wanted and why they were doing what they were doing, as opposed to my own ends, which was to understand who this like people were in this diverse society.
Right. And so as you explained so well, reading against the grain allows us to get at the lives of people who might not, you know, might not have left letters or diaries, but show up in other sources. So in this case, show up indirectly in a way, right? In this case, the police sources. Mm-hmm. And the history of the people, or the history of ordinary people, is certainly involves that technique of reading against the grain, which you're so good at. I always want to know more about that chef, as you know, so maybe one day, but you are onto this really, I think, neat next book project. And tell us a little bit about that. I think it grows directly out of your book, right?
Well, you know, I found, so it's I have a new title for the book, and you're going to be the first to know, Greg. It's A Magnificent Fraud, and that's a direct quote from a document. It's about the life of this man named Mamadou Alioune Kane, who was a Senegalese man who came to France in the probably during World War I, and then he returned in the 1920s. He started to call himself a prince and a wizard in the 30s, and then also became known as a Muslim religious leader, which he wasn't. He also collaborated with the Nazis during World War II. So it's kind of bringing me back to my World War II interest. So he is in some ways a con man and a scam artist, but he also has just this really interesting trajectory that I'm trying to use to, inform readers about the connections between France and West Africa just through his life. So the project did emerge from my original research because he shows up in a suspicious persons file in Dakar, which is where he was from originally. But ultimately, everything he did suspicion-wise, happened in France. And so I didn't end up writing about him in the book, but I, kind of saved him, put him aside, because everything he did, everything in the book takes place in Dakar, in French West Africa. Everything that he did almost exclusively took place in Paris. And so it's really a story about France and colonialism, but sort of flipped in that I'm taking the suspicious person from France, who is also an African person, and, you know, using his life to kind of get at some broader themes about the African community, what it meant to be an African person in France. So Kane was a French citizen because he was born in one of these, there's a few places in France where if you are born there as an African, you get citizenship automatically. So he was free to travel. He was French in terms of his citizenship, but he was also African and Senegalese. And he was really navigating this world by coming up with these, you know, scams and frauds. And I'm trying to think about him as like, he's both somebody who's like so reprehensible, and he's also so clever and interesting. And so I'm, you know, that's what I'm writing about in my new book. And I have all the primary research done. I'm just taking the time to work on the writing. And I'm really hoping that this book will be more geared towards a popular audience or a wider audience than my first book, which is, although I do think it is a pretty interesting read, as you said, it's still a scholarly monograph. And my new book is meant to be something that like undergrads would really enjoy reading. You know, it'll elucidate all the themes about like French colonialism in West Africa and then World War One, and why did Senegalese people end up fighting in World War One, and then this immigrant community that was, they're not, some of them are immigrants, some of them are just migrants because they were citizens, that was emerging in Paris in the 20s. And he married a French woman, he drove a taxi, he had a fruit stand. So in some ways, his life is really reflective of that kind of typical migrant experience. And then he sort of goes off into this area where he's like, I'm a prince, I'm a wizard, and gains notoriety for that and fame. He traveled to New York and was part of the World's Fair there in 1939.
As part of an exhibit or what?
He wanted to be. he got credentials as a journalist, but then he kind of like tried to set up a sort of booth, I guess you would call it, where he could like, give, he started telling fortunes eventually. I'm not sure if he was doing it in New York, but he was just like sort of a freelance exhibitor. he would wear a costume. He was very tall and he would wear a turban, and the New York Times wrote about him at the time. And he supposedly married an African-American woman and brought her back to France. And he had a wife, he had multiple wives. And so he's just really a character, and he's got kind of like with my first book, he's got a fascinating life, and that's what has drawn me into his story. But then, I try to, as a historian, be able to say like, what can we learn about the time period from studying.
Yes. That you do that so well in the first book, and I'm sure, I know you will in the second book too, which is to use these lives to get at these broader themes in the history of French colonialism in West Africa. This guy, I was thinking, it sounds like you do know what this fellow, like what Kane looks like. Are there photographs?
There are many newspaper photographs of him. And so he had several court cases, because in 1941, he was tried for black market activity during the war. He's put on trial, and he wore his turban to the court. He also had all these close relationships with Senegalese politicians, though, and he'd wear a suit in a picture where he'd be photographed with politicians. And then he was put on trial again in 1945 for treason, and he was convicted of treason. So yes, I have many photographs of him. They're not they're from newspaper clippings, so the quality's not always great. But yes, I absolutely know what he looks like, and there are many police reports about him, which is So there's that's another thing that I like about this project. It has a lot of diversity of sources. So in my first book, I relied largely on police sources. And with this, I have police sources, but I also have court records and newspaper articles. And he also has written a lot of defenses of himself and tons of correspondence, because whenever he was in trouble, he would be trying to get out of trouble by like petitioning judges and things like that. So I also have his voice, and it's one of these things where like every sentence is like, supposedly this happened, because there's a lot of, he is trying to con people. So it's hard to know when to trust him. Interesting thing is he was actually on trial for denouncing another Senegalese person to the Gestapo. And that person was supposedly killed. And so all these Senegalese testified against him. So
it's really, you raise an interesting point. I mean, which is, if you're writing about a con man or woman, how, as a historian, that makes it even trickier. What can you trust? What's reliable in the evidence? Is this fellow, is Kane also being surveilled by the police in New York?
I don't know. And I would love to find that out. In fact, I have had thoughts about going to the New York Public Library and seeing if I could find anything in terms of the World's Fair, like if there was any photographs of him there, or I haven't done research in the US, Greg, so I don't know how to do that.
But this is going to be a new direction for you.
I would love to do that. And it's something I have thought about doing. I would love to do at some point, just to see. I have no idea. I'm not sure how closely those kinds of records would be kept. I mean, even in France, he was arrested many times, and I don't have the specific files. I mostly have these like summary reports that say what happened. So I'm not sure how detailed that type of thing would be, that if it still exists, but.
Maybe you'll even find his exhibit booth. Who knows? Whatever. Yeah. It just sounds like a lot of fun and very interesting, and also illuminating of the larger history you're really interested in, which is the connections between France and West Africa. Mm-hmm. And this will definitely be a movie. I mean, my goodness.
I hope so.
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk a little bit about your teaching. I mean, I know how much you're like any good teacher, excellent teacher, your research informs your teaching. Certainly does in your case. I've had the pleasure of sitting in on a number of your courses. And I know you've really worked hard at innovating your teaching. And two projects in particular I'd like you to talk a bit about. One is the project related to the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya in the 1950s. And the other one involves having students use the Lutheran Lutheran Church Archives at Gustavus. But tell us a little bit about those innovations.
Sure. So I got interested in the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya, which happened in the 1950s, and is a topic that is, the more I get into it, the more complicated it is. It's something that's really misunderstood. It was described by the British as being this kind of like savage outbreak of violence, when actually it was an organized anti-colonial nationalist movement. And I started having my students read books about it, and then I had them doing locating primary resources. There are a lot of memoirs about the Mau Mau Rebellion. And even the name itself is like a controversial thing, because Mau Mau was like this like Britishization of a word, Muhimu, which is a word that means the important ones. But anyways, so usually I put the word Mau Mau in quotes, just so you know. Okay. And anyways, I decided to do this project-based learning, which was something that I had learned about from colleagues at Gustavus. I decided to have them create a memorial or monument to the Mau Mau Rebellion. And in doing so, they needed to learn the history, try to make sense of all the different constituencies within it. So, you know, there's people that fought for Mau Mau, there's people that helped them, there are people that opposed them. So there were Kenyan people who worked for the British, you know, as the home guards. They were like basically the police. There were lots of, so the Mau Mau was something that was part of the Kikuyu ethnic group, but there were many Kenyans that were not Kikuyu, you know? And so like, I encouraged them to think about sort of all the different perspectives, and in doing so, to create a memorial or a monument. And I did this for the first time in fall of 2018, and the students had to basically design the monument. They didn't have to build it, but they had to give a lot of very specific specifications to how it was going to be built and what it was going to be made of and how they were going to raise the money. And so I'm transforming this project into a challenge seminar, which is part of the new curriculum, so that the entire course will be for students from multiple disciplines to study this event in history and then see if they can make sense of it. And, you know, I think this is so important now when we are talking about what kinds of memorials and monuments we want to have in our public spaces. How can they represent us? How can they represent multiple constituencies instead of just one part of society? So that's something that I think gives it a lot of resonance for our contemporary situation.
Absolutely. And in a way, so does your, not just in a way, it does your work on surveillance, since we live in this world where we're all surveilled one way or another. That project, I think, just sounds fantastic. And I'm glad to hear how you're going to move forward with it. Well, can you give us an example or two? What the students came up with?
Sure. So some of them were, so this is what I loved about the project too, is it allows students to be creative in ways that they normally wouldn't be in a paper. And I am not as creative in terms of, you know, artistic representation. So I love watching them do it. Some of them use, so the One of the major grievances of the Mau Mau was about land, and so many of them incorporated the Kenyan landscape into their memorial as a way to symbolize that. I remember one of my students was a geology major, and he selected a particular type of stone that was going to be used that would change color in the rain. And I can't remember exactly what the significance of it was, but you know, they had to explain what went into it. A lot of them used text. A lot of them tried to use text and images to tell the story of what happened as a way to memorialize it. Some of them picked a specific moment, like a particular massacre that happened, and tried to memorialize that and use that to give a broader, more national sense of mourning. So I told them they couldn't create a museum. It couldn't just be like, you know, learn about it. It had to really be sort of a physical thing that people could visit. And, you know, they talked about different ways you could interact with it. We actually studied the Vietnam Memorial in DC as an example, you know, because people have kind of made that monument their own in the aftermath. And so we talked about ways that they could imagine people, like, say, leaving a flower or, you know, memorializing a particular name or something like that. So they had all kinds of creative ideas, and they worked on it in groups. So I think they ended up coming up with like five different memorials. But
That's great. It just sounds fantastic. Excellent project. And then the other one I find really interesting, because it gets, again, gets students into the, not just the primary sources, but the archives. And we do have an archive in our library that's has some interesting stuff there. Talk to us a little bit about that project.
Sure. So I learned through Jeff Jensen, who's in the library, that there were archives of missionaries who had been to Tanzania as early as the 1920s. So these were Gustavus alumni who traveled to Tanzania as Lutheran missionaries, and they had left documents they had in later years collected their documents through the Lutheran Church archives. And they also have objects, things that they brought back. But what was really exciting to me was the idea that students could do primary research on African history right here at Gustavus, because it is hard to find sources in African history. And some of the sources, so these were a married couple is the main sources I use. They're Ruth and Hobart Johnson are the couple's name, and they Hobart was a doctor and a Lutheran missionary, and he kept a lot of notes about his discussions with people about Christianity that are super interesting. And he'll say things like, here's a proverb that I learned, or one of the best ones is like one of the people said to me, if Jesus was born so close to us, why are we only hearing about him now? You know, I think because Tanzania is closer to the Middle East than America is. So, there's all just a lot of interesting conversations.
That's wonderful. I love that one.
Yeah. So what I ended up doing, I've had a couple different iterations of this project. I had my students in groups select documents, and then they have to actually transcribe them, which, you know, at first they were kind of like, well, why transcribe it? We can just take a picture of it. But actually, like, a lot of them are a little bit difficult to read if they're handwritten, or maybe they have something crossed out. So you actually really have to make a choice about what is it saying. And so they transcribed them, they wrote introductions to them in class, they spent time analyzing them. And eventually I put together basically a digital primary source collection of these documents so that future students can read them and analyze them and interpret them. So it's something that's like a little bit of a crossover between my imperialism course and my African history course. So the imperialism course is the group that did the primary source project, where they selected, you know, and we talked about, like, how do you select a document? How do you find the one that needs to go in the collection? You know, is it the one that's easiest to read, or no, it should be something that you think is most interesting. And so we spent some time on that. And this way also, for in terms of preservation of the collection, every semester I don't have people going in there, but we have a digital version of it, and then we can read it. And so they, I think it was a really useful project in terms of thinking about sort of, you know, they read a lot of these primary sources in their classes, you know, the ones, the edited collections, to kind of let them see what goes into making that. And that's a part of being a historian.
Yeah, exactly. Too. That's one of the things I love about the project, that, you know, it's the raw materials and all, as you say, all the different it's a multi-layered project, and the different choices they have to make, including the choice about what does that document say if I can't quite make it out, and what to include in the collection. So yeah, it's just fantastic.
Yeah, it was interesting for them to kind of see, like, you know, there was a lot of discussion about imperialism as a negative force, which, you know, is not uncommon. You know, that's like how we often think of imperialism. But then seeing Ruth and Hobart, I think they started like identifying with them a little bit and thinking about it. You really do see them trying to like make sense of what's happening. They actually are almost like anthropologists, the missionaries themselves. And so they are really complicated people and interesting. And, you know, also Ruth has a memoir about her experience, which we looked at too. So,
oh, wow.
So all kinds of opportunities there. Yeah.
That's terrific. The, you know, thinking about this also reminded me, did you take students abroad or not? Or was that just something?
No, it's something I'd like to do. And the last time I was in France, I visited some World War II sites plan some future trip like that. But right now, that's not really happening. So
thinking about that. One day you will. You're just an example of the kind of exciting innovations that go on in our teaching at Gustavus and all schools, I guess. But know Gustavus best. And also, you know, that history, there's a history of everything, right? Our students still need to understand that. There's a history of surveillance. There's a history of what are the history of interactions between white missionaries or whatever they're calling themselves and those they are on mission to. Which kind of leads me into history itself. You and I both well know, any historian, professor of history knows that history is perhaps always kind of a tough sell. What can I do with the history major? But especially now with all of the emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. What, as a professor of history at a liberal arts college, what's your sales pitch for history? Why study history?
Well, usually I send them to talk to Greg Kastor because he's the ultimate salesman when it comes to history. Oh, but everyone knows that.
You're very good. You're very good.
But I mean, I guess I think what I tell them is, like, first of all, while you're in college, study what you love. You know, that was what I did. You know, I thought I'll try international relations. I'll try, you know, something that's more practical. And then I was like, no, that's not what I want to do. If you love history, if you love learning from it, you are going to be a successful person in whatever you choose to do. And that, you know, when you're studying history, you're developing so many skills. You know, historical thinking can help you tackle so many problems, you know, identifying what the problem is, what the question is, what are the sources that are going to help you answer the problem. Figuring out how many sources do I have? Do I have tons and I have to like skim through it? Or do I only have a few that I have to very carefully read? Those kinds of research skills, I think, are really valuable. But also just, you know, having a sense of the world, having an understanding of where we've come from. That's just, you know, everyone should have that, I think, you know. You know, we've talked about this, you and I have talked about this, how historians have to have empathy for people in the past. And just thinking back to the things we've been talking about, Cain, a subject in my book, you know, I have a suspicion of him because I think he's a con man, but I also have to have empathy to him as a historical actor. Why is he behaving this way? Who is he? You know, Ruth and Hobart Johnson, you know, okay, maybe I have a negative impression of missionaries in the colonial period, but, you know, let's try to flesh them out some more. And I think that the kind of empathy we get from seeing all the perspectives in history helps you be a really thoughtful and, you know, creative person, you know?
Agree. All, of course, music to my ears. And you mentioned too, in another context, about you know, the current pandemic giving you, and you talked about yourself, I guess, but, you know, an empathy for people living through the influenza pandemic of 1918 and not knowing, as we know, looking back, not knowing how it might end, where it might go. which I think is another really important part of having a historical consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I could go on forever. It's so much fun and so interesting. It's always a pleasure to talk to a fellow historian of your caliber, I should add. Thank you so much. Thank you for all your work as chair, two of our department in this, shall we say, challenging time, is an understatement. And we're recording this on the eve of classes beginning tomorrow. Goodness gracious. So yeah. I guess we both better get back to our syllabi. But best of luck with the classes. And I look forward to seeing you certainly on online, if not also in person.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Take
really
care.
Appreciate the opportunity.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Kate. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.